Accession number 10934, Rule 3.
General Royal, Rule 3. So, at that time in June 1940, who was it who was getting all the credit for this spectacular German advance? Was it the German generals or Hitler?
That's hard to say. I mean, this was his strategic plan. And what we know now, not in those days, as a lieutenant, you don't have the deep look inside what's going to happen. You see the outside as everybody else. Now we know there was a great plan of Manstein. And he had to convince Hitler, and he came back to this plan, which was very new and very unconventional, to break through the Ardennes with the tanks and without any secure situation on your flanks. Just moving forward and up to Dunkirk. The big surprise to us and to all of us was the stop. Hitler's order to stop at Dunkirk when the British Expeditionary Army was right down at the beach inside of the tanks. And everybody was, why? Why do we stop? And this is a... maybe we never get the answer. You know, Hitler had some love-hate situation to England, and maybe he didn't... the same situation, 1866, Bismarck and Moltke at Königgrätz, you know. Moltke wanted to march to Vienna, and Bismarck says, no, that is our next ally. Maybe some sort of feeling caused that order for stopping. Maybe he wanted to use England in a further cause of the war.
Now, after this, the next great battle in the air was, of course, the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
In Britain, we always call the beginning of the Battle of Britain in July 1940.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did it begin as far as you were concerned, personally?
You know, I was very early. It was right after the armistice in France. My wing was taken back to Germany, and we were equipped at Jever with dinghies and to fly over the sea. We trained fly over the sea, just heading time and this time. And then we came to pretty soon through Leeuwarden, the Netherlands, where we spent one or two nights, and then to Coquel, near Calais. And when we landed at Coquel, the farmer just has cut the grain the day before. So there was a brand new field with the cut grain, a little bit curved, and my squadron was stationed one side, on the other side, two other squadrons. We couldn't see each other. There was a
hedge?
No. This was shaped like this, you know. We were here, they were here, we took off, met right in the middle, like a little hill.
Hillock.
Yeah, hillock. This was a brand new area for us, a brand new enemy. And I hadn't met the Royal Air Force before. And we were not very successful. We were not very experienced at all. Because the only experience I had was this one
dogfight
mix up with the French the 12th of May and nothing else. So we had to escort, primarily, we had to escort 287, which was an obsolete aircraft anyway in this area against the British with the Spitfire and the Hurricanes. And we got the order for flying direct escort. In most cases, the rendezvous was over Boulogne. And we met over Boulogne in 4,000, 5,000 meters. And then we escorted this 287 heavily loaded lay across the channel to Margate, Ramsgate, and the British ports, and convoys who came down the channel from the Thames mouth and down the channel. And I remember, you know, this was very, very difficult to stay with them at speed, not as we were used to sweep or to stagger. No, at the same altitude, and given up all the advantages of speed, altitude, whatsoever, and flexibility, maneuverability. And so we had heavy losses. Right after the first missions, we lost our group commander. I lost my squadron commander. He was shut down, and the weather was not very good. And the Spitfires just waited for us upstairs and came out of the clouds, high speed, dashed on us and pulled up again. So we lost a lot of airplanes, and after two, three missions, we had the squadron commanders lost and the group commanders. So I, as a lieutenant, I had to take over the 8th Squadron. And from there on, I was squadron commander in the 8th Squadron for the next 3.5 years.
Do you remember the names of the those people who
were
lost?
Yeah, the group commander was Major von Huwald. My squadron commander was Captain Ehrlich. I think it was Captain or First Lieutenant, anyhow, Ehrlich. And he was shut down, and he bailed out, and his wingmen saw him dashing into the very rough sea those days, and then he was pulled and disappeared and never showed up again. He obviously got drowned in the British Channel. This was this was not very successful. We stayed there for, we learned our lessons with the Spitfires, with the Hurricanes, but we didn't gain experience. And we were not in a free fighter engagement. We always had to escort somebody, you know, and in most cases, the 287, which was in speed and maneuverability very inferior to all the other aircraft flying around. After this period, we were pulled out and sent back to Germany for rebuilding because we had to lose too many. And first of all, we lost all the important functions, squadron commanders and group commander.
So do you remember the date when you were pulled out?
No, this was June, late June. Unfortunately, I don't have my logbook anymore. But it was late June, and we flew missions. So I remember that Ramsgate, Margate, Hastings, Dover, then convoys in the Channel. We flew up to 3 missions a day.
Do you remember any particular incidents that happened then that you can recount?
Incidents? What type of?
Any. Just anything that happened to you, anything that sticks out in your mind?
Yes, I was in a dogfight with, you know, coming out of this very inferior position against this. Certainly, you never, the 287, they dived down, and we were engaged in a dogfight. But we had to pull up speed, and, you know, from an inferior position, and bring them back again. So there was not a very enjoyable situation. And as I mentioned, even we couldn't gain experience in a dogfight also, because it was not a free dogfight to measure your capabilities versus a very capable opponent. It wasn't possible.
So you weren't able to shoot anybody down?
No, I didn't. I wasn't successful. Then we were pulled out, and there was only some lieutenants who were leading all the 3 squadrons, the 7th, 8th, and 9th squadron in that wing. And we came back to Germany, Zerbst, and to near Berlin, and were rebuilt. We got new pilots, new group commander. We trained very well. We got new equipment. And it took up. Then we were taken back to Germany, as I mentioned, and rebuilt and retrained very intensively. Particularly my squadron, I was a young squadron commander, I wanted to get a good fighting squadron. And we flew every day, two missions, morning, afternoon. And we're a well-formed squadron. And at the end of 40, September, October, we got the order to, we got a new commander, group commander, and then we got the order to get down to Vienna, south of Vienna, to Pandorf. And there we got a new order and maps to go to Romania, to Bucharest. The whole thing was a little bit secret, you know. We didn't get the full... We couldn't imagine what to do in south of Vienna and Pandorf, so the war was in the west. In the east, there was nothing. You know? Poland was over, and nothing happened there. So why to go to Pandorf? And we were told you will get new orders in Pandorf, which is Neusiedler Lake, south of Vienna.
When there we stayed, this was?
This was fall 40. And then we got the order and maps and everything to go to Romania, to Bucharest, Pipera. And the order was to protect the oil wells and to train the Romanians as far as he flew the 109. In those days, it was a very particular mission because officially Romania was a neutral country. And in Romania in those days, there was still the American, British, French, Russian representation by the embassies. German. And I remember very well, that was the birthday of the, you know, the King Carol has left with Madame Lupescu, and the new king was King Mihai, his son. Very fine gentleman and highly respected, but very young. And he had a birthday parade. There was the troops, the Romanian troops marched, there were the German officers on the grandstand together with the American ambassador. Yeah, it was a little bit funny. Okay, we were there and flew and got acquainted with the area and flew together with the Romanians and had a very good relationship with them. And beginning 41, in January 41, when I came, that time I could go on the Christmas vacation, went back to Germany and took quite a time to go by a train. But it was a quiet area. Yeah. And when I returned in January 41, I think, one night I was invited with a friend of mine, full uniform, to a Romanian dinner party. It was near the castle in Bucharest, and it was snowing and cold. And we stayed as pilots in a hotel in Romania. You know, every day with bus forth and back to the base. Pipera was right at the outskirts of Bucharest. And when I came back from this party, it was about late at night, 11 o'clock at night, we walked back to the hotel. It was dark, snow. And I recognized six pistol shooting, you know, bang, 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 bang. And we rushed to the main street and saw a German officer just collapsing and a civilian, huge man, running away. And we followed him, shouted, and we got him. And when we approached him, he was throwing away a pistol in a snow. And then some taxi drivers came. They also followed him, surrounded him. He couldn't escape. To make the long story short, this guy came in from Turkey. We were supposed he had a mission by the Secret Service to shoot the German commanding general. General Hansen. He was a leader of the German delegation down to an attachment down in Romania. And you know, a channel has on its pants these red stripes and these breeches. And this guy was seen when he watched through the window in the Café Bucharest, which was in the hotel, in the building of the hotel. It was downstairs, Café Bucharest, with a gypsy playing violin and things like that. And there was a German officer with red stripes at his breeches. But he was a German staff officer. That's a different red. And he was a lieutenant colonel. And he shot him and he killed him. And subsequently to this, when his ceremony, when he was buried, and it was a big ceremony, and Romanians escorted this, and the Romanians were split. There was the Iron Guard with Hoyasima, and the official side was General Antonescu. He was a prime minister. And there some kind of a revolution started. There was a lot of shooting among the Romanians in Bucharest. And we as Germans were in between. No? We went every day out to the airport, and there was two circles. The inner circle was the legal troops, and the outer circle was the rebels, the Hoyasiba, the Iron Guard. And everybody was greeting the Germans. Both needed the Germans. And they were friendly with us, but they shoot at each other. And it continued, well, it was a hell of a confusion in the country. And finally, Antonescu was supported by Hitler as the official leader. And they dropped Hoyasima and his Iron Guard. And after a couple of weeks, the whole thing was over. And we continued as before. And I was there until we moved into Greece. Then we went down to Athens, and I attended. Then my group was engaged in the conquering of the Isle of Crete.
Crete was the next time that you were in action after the battles over the Channel. Where were you stationed in the
Crete operation? We were in the South Peloponnese, in Molai. You won't find it even on the map. This was just
How do you spell it?
I don't know what it's a Greek spelling, like Molai. M-O-L-L-A-Y-I, Molai. But maybe this is wrong. It was a very, very old village, farmer's village, in the south Peloponnese. And from there we flew every morning up from 4 o'clock in the morning, our missions up to Crete.
How big a German unit was stationed?
It was a group. A group. There was my group, no, two groups, and another wing, the wing 77, I think. And we were under the command of that wing, my group. And but we got our orders how to fly, and so we did. We flew across the Mediterranean from Kythera, Antikythera to Crete Island, you know. And then at that time, this was a lousy battle, you know, with tremendous losses. But finally, the Germans had made it, but it was just at stake.
Why was it such a lousy battle for you?
You know, first of all, not for us, for the whole German forces. The whole operation was known to the to our opponents there. It was British and was New Zealanders, and they knew there was some how do you call it, verraten, some intelligence action, and they knew that they were coming. That was number one. They were prepared. Number two, the parachuters were dropped at a too high altitude. There was too long of the parachute. And they just jumped into the positions of the New Zealanders and just shot them at the parachute. There was the Sturm Regiment of the regiment, one of the parachuters, almost wiped out. The next thing was, they were pulled back, you know, gliders were pulled too great. and they cut the cable, and they've sailed down, and there's a very hilly island, and they just didn't have any landing field. They just crashed into this olive plantage, and the other got killed, and so this was a very, very tricky situation. Then, for instance, the Germans dropped containers for machine guns, you know, machine guns to support the troops. And the machine guns were involved in the swastika flags to lay out as a forward line. But they dropped it into the New Zealander position. And they pulled it out. And we didn't know who is who, you know. There was a swastika flag as a forward line signal. But they were New Zealanders. So this was a mix-up at the quite a time, you know, the very first weeks. And the whole thing was really at stake, but finally they made it. And the British and the New Zealand escaped the southern part to North Africa. They were taken over at night by boats and ships and so on. So we didn't like this operation at all. It was no fighting in the air. We had to fly ground attacks, not with a very, very unknown situation, you know. And this was after 2 or 3 weeks, I don't know how long it lasted, then when the whole thing was over and Crete was in firm hands, we were put back to Athens and back to Romania.
If I can just ask you more about Crete. Yeah. So your targets were at Malmö Aerodrome, were they?
Malmö Aerodrome at that time was in German hands, but it was heavily shuttered, you know. There was a... I have pictures over there. Artillery on a hill. Malmö was almost at the beach, very close to the beach. And then there was, in a line of sight, artillery, and they really shot in a direct shot the incoming 252s and fighters and whatsoever. And we landed. And the other disadvantage of Malmö was if you took off with the propeller, you whirled up red sand, dust. You couldn't see very much, you know. It was all red. This is this red-colored dust, sand. And there were a lot of collisions because there was no organization. You know, they took her from this side, the other one came from this side, and they crashed in the middle. So we lost in Malmö, as I don't know whether this is a firm number, but I was told that we lost more than 100, far beyond 100, 252. This was a tremendous serious loss of transport. And I just underline this because later on in Russia, where we are really stuck with the transport aircraft, there was no moving possible in the time where you have mud, muddy roads and ice or snow and whatsoever. We didn't have our trucks. We sent the trucks back to Poland and never saw my trucks. I have always moved with 252, but there was two less because this loss was never remade up. You know, this was a tremendous loss.
So, in using Malmö Airfield, how intense was the flak? How intense was the anti-aircraft fire?
I was not, when we came in, I didn't recognize the anti-aircraft fire. First of all, we just landed in Malmö, refueled and flew a mission. We never stayed overnight. We stayed in the Peloponnese. And what we recognized was this direct shooting from this artillery from the New Zealanders, which was then taken by German parachuters, by a lot of got killed. You know, I still have the photograph with the helmets and the at least 10, 15 bodies laying around when they took this gun, a big gun. And from there on, there was silence. But it caused a lot of lives.
Was your fuel supply all right then? Did you have enough fuel?
My pumps, you know. We had enough fuel, yes. In those days we had enough fuel compared with later dates, times. Particularly at the end in Germany, we really didn't get fuel.
We'll say more about that later. Yeah. But in the battle for Crete, did you also have attacks on the ships, on the Royal Navy ships?
Not we, but I know friends who attacked this destroyer, you know, in the Suda Bay, and it burned out.
This was the like, York.
Huh? The York. And strangely enough, you know, I paid a visit many years later to South Africa. I was 1974, fall 74, I was in South Africa. And I was a guest in Simonstown from the admiral of the South African Navy. And we started talking. I was like, well, I was in a war in the Mediterranean. So I was like, oh, where have you been? And so finally, I recognized he was a lieutenant of the York. And I was a pilot as a lieutenant circling the York. But the York at that time was already burned out in the Suda Bay.
So after Crete, you said that you had to go back to Romania.
To Romania. We went back to our base, not to Bucharest. We went up to Misil, which is, I don't know whether there's a base still. It was some kind of an emergency field with some barracks around there. And we got new airplanes. This was an important thing. We got the 109F with round wing tips and the new engine. It was a perfect aircraft in those days. We loved it. We felt very superior. And pretty soon there was a build-up in forces in Romania. We couldn't imagine what all this is about. Until an officer from the army came and said, yeah, we come in and here we go to war against Russia. You know, nobody could believe that. It's like against the doctrine, you know, a two-front war. In the West, this war hasn't been finished. There's still a strong enemy. Why to go to Russia? But you know what we know now, and this great strategic target, Hitler's was Russia. This was his objective of the war. And all other things, all other operations were deviation of